Welcome, everyone, to week 10. This is an exciting week because tomorrow is quiz one, which we will get to in a second. Today in section, we are going to go over some resources for the quiz, and then I will answer any and all questions you guys have, and we'll finally end with some practice problems. We can spend the entire section answering questions. We can spend the entire section going over practice problems. We'll just expand to fill the space and time we have. So I put this list up every week, but it's particularly important this week for studying. If you haven't started already, oh boy. But hopefully you've started already and you are going through the materials and resources listed here. I would highly recommend a number of these. In particular, lecture notes are incredibly important and helpful. The study.cs50.net provides a great primer on a lot of the topics we've covered and also has some great practice problems. And then Google's great, too. I don't know what you'd use it for, but use Google as well. Reach out to me if you have any questions, comments, or concerns. Look over the review session slides from last night, or if you have some time, watch the video. They provide a lot of helpful material and information, and try and cover, if not all, many of the topics we've covered and that you might see on the quiz. Speaking of the quiz, that will be tomorrow. It's 75 minutes long. Many of you are taking it at 1 o'clock, and some of you are taking it at 5:30. For the time you're taking it and the location you're taking it, make sure you check out the document on the cs50.net homepage. Remember that you can get one 8.5 by 11 sheet to take with you. Oftentimes, people don't use this sheet at all during the quiz, but really, it is an incredibly helpful study tool. So putting together that sheet is what I spent probably 3 or 4 hours doing when I was studying for CS50, and that was easily the most helpful way I could study for the quiz. So even if you have some other people's study guides to look at or use as references, I highly recommend making your own study guide, putting that stuff together. That really helps you learn all of the material. Last but not least in this section, after the quiz tomorrow, there's one more lecture next Monday. There's one more section, not next Tuesday before Thanksgiving, but the Tuesday after that. We'll be meeting together for a final goodbye party and also doing some cool things to get you guys excited about further studies in computer science. There's one more project, one more fair, one more hackathon. We are nearing the end of CS50, which is exciting, but also, if you're like me, a little sad. Before I move on, does anybody have any questions about what we've covered so far? OK, well, let's go over some questions that you guys have for the quiz and topics we might cover. So this is a list that I put together. It is by no means exhaustive, but hopefully will jog your memory if you have some questions about any of these topics or if you have questions about practice problems from quizzes in years past. I had a couple questions that were emailed to me, but I want to hold off on those for a second. Does anybody have any questions? Problems they didn't understand, answers they didn't understand, to get us started. Avi.
Can you just go over DOM and AJAX really quick? Like what we need to know or shouldn't understand about them?
OK. I'm going to answer generally this question of what do I need to know about given topic X? Because I have a feeling many of you are going to ask me that or are curious about that. So if, to the extent that the topic was covered in lecture or section, or on study.cs50.net, or in a problem set, you should be familiar with it. So you don't need to know every type of tag that's available in HTML, or every type of attribute or something property you can give something in CSS. But if you saw it in a lecture example, if you saw it in the problem set, you should probably be familiar with it, particularly things you saw in lecture. So you saw, we discussed the document object model a bit in section. More so in lecture, you should be familiar with that much of it. And you should be familiar with AJAX to the same extent. We never saw incredibly advanced or complicated examples of AJAX, so you're not going to be asked to do something incredibly complicated. But you might be asked, how do I make an AJAX call using jQuery, which is something you've seen a number of times before, both in the review session and in lecture. And it's only 2-ish lines of code. So that is something you should be familiar with. But again, for all these topics, if you've seen it before, it is fair game. And we might ask you, obviously, we're going to ask you things you haven't seen before, or coding something you haven't seen before, which isn't to say you haven't seen the tools to solve that problem before. You have seen those tools. For example, on quiz one, if you need to code Sterlin, we haven't coded Sterlin before, but you know how to use a for loop, you know how to use if conditions, you know how to write variables in C. It's going to be the same thing here. You're not going to be asked to do anything you haven't seen before, but you might be asked to like put something together in a novel way or solve a different type of problem. Sorry that wasn't specific to your question, but I can't answer about every single topic what you do or do not need to know. But also, sorry, last thing on that, we have spent significantly more time on linked lists than we have on AJAX. You didn't use AJAX in a problem set. One problem set, like one of the central features of that problem set was linked lists, and we spent a lot of time in lecture and section using it. So odds are linked lists will come up more often on a quiz than AJAX will. Or the questions having to do with linked lists will be worth more points. So you can certainly focus and narrow in on things that are more likely to come up because we've spent more time on them. OK, any other questions? Yeah?
Can we go over the use of anonymous functions in JavaScript? I'm sort of a little confused about that.
OK. So in JavaScript, I am trying to think how I could write this on. So let's actually open up this code. OK. So this is code that we did last week. And you've seen this before. If you were here in section last week, or you've seen something similar to this before, but you can look at this first line. This is how you start. Everybody's seen this before. If you want to put some JavaScript code, you put it inside this. Assuming you're using jQuery, this is saying don't do anything till the document's loaded. And then Kurt, you see right here, we're doing something like this: function open paren close paren. So we are not giving this function a name. We are not going to define how this function is supposed to run and then call it a bunch of times. We're just saying that this document.ready takes a function, a couple of things to do. And we don't want to spend the time giving it a name or save it for perpetuity. We just want to like run some things. So an anonymous function sort of serves that purpose. When you don't want, like, you're not going to use something over and over again, so you don't need to give it a name. You just want to use it once. You just say function, for example, in this case, and you're just defining something that you could give a name. Like, we could pull this function out and give it a name and then call that function here, but we don't need to because we don't want to waste time giving it a name or wasting something in our namespace. And you'll see that a lot. For example, we see that a lot in this code, but you've seen this before. When you click something, run this type of code, we could define the code that we want to run when we click this, in this case, this ID, as a separate function, and then run that function. But in this case, we're just skipping that step and moving it into here and just defining everything that we want to happen and not giving it a name. That still might have not answered your question.
No, it does. I mean, it makes sense. I guess I just don't really get why it would be a function at all, though, because it's not really being called and doesn't really have a name.
It's a function in the sense that it's a series of steps, okay, like you would put in a function. Then that's why we call it an anonymous function. We're not going to give it a name. We're not going to waste trying to name it. But we could. Anonymous functions, you can always give a name. So for example, this code right here, we could put this code inside a function and then call this function here. Instead, we say we're not going to bother with that. We're just going to write it all right here. It's like sometimes in when you're writing a for loop in C, you guys have seen this before. Maybe you're iterating through a for loop. Int I equals 0, I is less than Sterlin, or you're going through some array. You can save like array index I in some variable, and you use that variable, so you don't need to rewrite array bracket I over and over and over. And that's sort of like a dummy variable. It's not serving much purpose other than to make your code a bit cleaner and easier to read. Similar function here. Just makes it a bit easier, but functionally there's no difference. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Madhu?
The review session yesterday, they often put like function parentheses event. Does that mean something, or is that like for things like that, they would do like document.ready function event.
So an event, you guys, we've seen this, and again, these are smaller things that probably I don't want to spend too much time on, because sometimes I don't want people to get freaked out that they haven't heard about these things that much. But we talked a bit about event handlers. So something happens, and then this function is executed. And then we also want to know some details about what happened in this event. So think back to problem set 4. That's probably the easiest way to understand that. In breakout, there was some code, like an event would happen, but event can mean many things. It could mean the mouse was clicked. It could mean you hit an arrow key, et cetera, et cetera. but it's all saved in this generic thing called event. And then we can say, like, is this event this thing, or is this event this thing, or what sort of happened with that event? So that's why you create that variable there to save that extra information about what exactly happened that you're going to want to utilize in the function. But again, that's probably one of the less important things to be super familiar with. OK. What other questions have people had or stumbling blocks they've encountered while reviewing? We'll go back to that list. What about during quizzes, practice quizzes, if people have taken those already? What were some problems that tripped you guys up? I know for a fact last year's quiz was really hard. Yeah.
Can you explain what an SQL injection attack is?
OK, great. So we talked about this a bit. There was a lecture on security. And again, as I mentioned earlier, so this is an aside, but you will be frustrated on the quiz when you read some small two-point question. You're like, when did I ever learn that? All of those things in those lectures that you didn't think you needed to know, or you could gloss over because it didn't have to do with the problem set, those will likely come up again on the quiz. So cool, fun things that you just thought David was telling you for you to enjoy. He was telling you for you to enjoy and to make you just be super excited about learning everything there is to learn about computer science. Those things also come up on quizzes. So even these small things that didn't directly relate to your problem set, as you guys are familiar with from Quiz Zero, will probably come up. And this is a good example of something. So a SQL injection attack is when you're going to put some information. You get some information from the user, and you want to insert it into a table using a SQL insert statement. But you didn't sanitize the input ahead of time. So obviously, we've seen SQL statements. I'll just open up. Let's go to. We'll go to the review set. I think who covered it? I think Samila did. So we can get an.
Where did you find this?
So if you go to cs50.net, quizzes, and then you can scroll over and get slides from the review session. But you can see this is a good example of a SQL injection attack. We take some information from the user, and they give us a string, and then we want to insert that string into a database. Generally, we are going to sanitize that input, which means there are some characters that are dangerous. For example, in SQL strings, these quotes, single quotes or double quotes, mean something. They mean end this string here. And so if the user gives you a single or a double quote, that they could be trying to trip up your SQL query and insert some bad stuff into it. And if they do that, they could gain control of your database or do some things that you don't want them to do. So that's why whenever we take SQL queries, we sanitize the input before putting it into the database, which means we escape those characters. And we'll talk about that in a second. But long story short, a SQL injection attack is if you don't do that, if you don't take care of the input they give you before putting in your database, they can, as you see down here, run a query that, in fact, select. So they put in their code down here, and this select line down here will select everything from the table regardless of what the password is given, because you have the or 1 equals 1. So it's basically, long story short, a way to take over the database. The question then for you guys is, where in pset 7 did you sanitize all of the inputs to your SQL queries? Where did that stuff happen? Where do you prevent SQL injection attacks from happening in pset 7?
Oh, yeah. Crypt?
So it wasn't crypt.
What'd you say? Yeah, that's what.
It happens in, and we didn't make you do this for this particular problem set, but it happens in the query function. And so we actually wrote it for you, and we took care of the sanitizing the inputs for you. But in years past, sometimes students have had to sanitize the inputs on their own. In PSET 7, a lot of you, let me open up one other file. Public. So you'll notice up here, a lot of people in Problem Set 7 did not call this function on strings. This function, HTML special chars, again, this string might have some things that in HTML means something else. Like a brace, a square, or an angle bracket means something in HTML. And so if you print that out to the screen, or if you just take that and print that out to your HTML, that might do something you don't expect. So HTML special chars goes over all those characters that have special meaning and escapes them. So it gets printed out as a string, not as, or as the text you want to see, rather than screwing up your HTML. We called that function in the header, and a lot of people forgot to call that function in the code you were writing. So for example, if a stock name had an angle bracket in it, and you forgot to call this function, that angle bracket could have thrown off what your HTML looked like. But calling this function will escape that, so it actually prints out as an angle bracket and doesn't throw off your HTML code. It's the same reason we've seen sometimes slashes before double quotes in a printf line, because we don't want the double quotes to end the string. We want to print them out to the screen. So all of this is the same idea. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind of.
Do you have a follow-up?
So I guess, like, the SQL injection attack has to do with that? Or, like, I don't understand how the two are related. Like, why would you need the special chars?
OK. So the SQL injection attack is when you inject some malicious strings into somebody's program, and they just take it and run the SQL query with the string you gave them. And as you can see down here, that could be problematic. So the way you prevent against that is you take their string that they give you, so this string right here, and you sanitize it. You escape all of the things that are potentially problematic. So you don't interpret them as something that means something. And an example of that with HTML is this function.
Okay.
So we do the same, it's the same idea here. And I was just showing you other examples of when you've seen this idea before, of escaping user input before printing it out to a screen or putting it inside a SQL statement.
So in this case, the user is messing with the programmer.
Yes. With all of these security attacks, that's always generally the user or somebody is trying to mess with you, the programmer.
Okay, got it.
And these are the ways you can prevent against them. Yeah?
So I have a question about hash functions.
Okay.
In quiz 1 from 2011, there are two questions about one-sided hashes. And yeah, I was just wondering what that meant.
Okay. Which quiz? 2011?
Yeah.
Quiz 1?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a different kind of hash function. That's like hashing a password. It's not like putting things in.
What question was it?
I think it was 9 or 10, or both.
All right, go ahead, Kurt. You can answer while we look at it.
I think it's talking about like hashing a password. Like when someone enters a password, you turn it into like an encrypted thing. And that's like the password hash, which is different from like a hash function that puts something into a hash table.
Let's see. Let me pull up what they give as the answer, and then we'll walk through it. So Kurt gave a great example of a one-way hash. When we've seen this before, we take the password and turn, in PSET 7, somebody might have a password that's just password, but then it gets encrypted in some really long thing. The one-way hash means it is very easy to go from one way to the other, but it's very hard to go from the other way back. And so you know when you were checking people's passwords in Problem Set 7, you would take their, so for example, say you wanted to change their, they wanted to change their password, you asked them for their old password. You took their old password, you encrypted it, and then compared the two encryptions rather than unencrypting their original one, because it's really hard to go that way.
Okay.
Yeah?
How in depth does our understanding of Telnet have to be?
Most of, if it was mentioned briefly in lecture, just a brief understanding. Again, back to the answer to obvious question. Things that have come up, the more things come up, the more likely it is you have to be super familiar with them. If they've only come up in lecture, that's just one place. But if they come up in lecture, section, and a problem set, then you probably have to be super familiar with them. So I had a question from earlier about, it was fall 2010. Quiz one, let's pull up. This question on stacks and queues, which we did spend a fair bit of time talking about in lecture, even though we didn't really ever hit it in section. So this question is giving you a series of commands and asking you to what gets printed in this case. So this is a totally reasonable question that could be asked of you guys, and then you guys should be able to answer it. So why don't you take a look at it for 30 seconds, and then if anybody wants to propose the answers to me, and then we'll walk through it. All right, who has an answer to question 27? Yeah.
Is it 1, 2, 3, 3?
That's right. 27 is 1, 2, 3, 3. So let's look at how we got that. First, we're saying if S is a queue, what gets printed? So a queue is first in, first out. We've seen that before. We saw the picture of the people waiting at the Apple Store to buy some product. The first people in are the first people out. The first things in a queue are the first things out. So if we push something into a queue, we push the 1, then we pop the 1. Pop just means take out. In this case, just take something out. We take out the first thing, so that's a 1. So we'll put things we print down over here. This is no longer in our queue. Then we push on a 2 and a 3. And we pop off the first thing, again, because it's a queue. So we get a 2. Then we put on another 3 and call pop again. Our 3 is first. And then we add a whole bunch of other things and call pop. But again, since this is a queue, first in, first out, we take out the first thing that was ever put in. That's our 3. And in this case, we don't worry about all those other things. So that's if this is a queue. Any questions about a queue? A stack's different. What is the acronym we have for understanding a stack?
Last in, first out.
LIFO, I think. Last in, first out. So we saw an example of a stack of trays in a dining hall. Whatever tray's on top gets picked up. And then if new trays come in, they get put on top. And then whatever's on top gets picked up. So those trays on the bottom might stay there for a while. In that case, again, we'll draw this out. We push on 1, so 1 is first in line. And then we pop something off. Well, there's only one thing in there, so we move 1 down here. Then we put on 2 and 3, and we pop something off. But again, since this is a queue, or this is a stack, rather, we take whatever was in last. Whatever's in last comes out first, and 3 was in last. So we put the 3 down there. Then we put on another 3. And we pop something again. Finally, we put on the 4, 5, 6, and 7. And here we pop. And because it's a stack, we take whatever was put in last and write that down here. So we end up with 1, 3, 3, 7. Does anybody have any questions about stacks or queues or this example? OK, let's go back to the list of topics. Not that way, this way. What other questions do people have? Yeah?
I was confused about, I don't know how important this is, but I was confused about the difference between different types of languages, like markup, compiled, interpreted.
That's a good question. I think that is somewhat important, so let's go over it quickly. We have the big languages we've seen so far are C, PHP, and JavaScript. In terms of programming languages. HTML, as you mentioned, is not a programming language. It's a markup language. And then we have CSS, which is also not a programming language. We've also seen SQL, which is not a programming language either. So SQL allows you to write queries for a database. HTML is a markup language. It defines how things are structured. And CSS allows you to style things. That's probably the extent for what you need to know about those three. But it is more interesting to figure out the differences between C, PHP, and JavaScript. So one of the biggest differences, as you mentioned, is how they're compiled, or whatever the equivalent is. So C is compiled. We would always run a compiler. And then where are your errors when you run the C compiler? Where does it show you the errors in your code? Like, how do you know there's an error in your code in C? It shows you in the terminal as you're compiling. And if there are errors, it won't actually compile it. So you know that there are errors right away, ahead of time, before you even run your code. Of course, you might run your code and get a segmentation fault. But that was probably because you did some silly logic thing. But your code was technically all correct and could run. So C code gets compiled ahead of time. What about PHP code? Where were errors in your PHP code? How did you know you had errors in your PHP code?
Runtime?
Yeah, when you would run it, you would run the PHP code in the back, and then you'd display a screen. You might see some things at the top, but then you would see like some orange, ugly table, and it would say, give you a line number and say, blah, 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 this stuff didn't work. So PHP is interpreted line by line and executed on the server, and then the result is sent over to you. Great. Executed in the server line by line and then sent over to you. And if there's an error, it'll send you the error. But you might have gotten some stuff ahead of time. So some of it might have worked, but later on, some stuff might not have worked. What about JavaScript? Where did you see JavaScript errors? In PSET 8, when you got an error, how'd you know? Where did it show up?
The console at the bottom.
In the console, on the bottom. It would say, it would also give you the line number, and it would show up on the bottom. And JavaScript was not executed on the server. JavaScript was sent to your computer. And then when it was time to run, the JavaScript was run line by line on the client, on your side. Not the server, the client side. And that was similarly, it was run line by line. And then when you would get an error, it would show down up, it would show up at the bottom. Similarly to PHP, some of it might execute, and then you might get an error later on. Also, a little unlike PHP, if you got a JavaScript error, say you didn't do the right code for an alert box, you could keep running your program. The JavaScript, that the alert box wouldn't work, but your program would be fine. Just maybe that function would fail. So those are some of the biggest differences in terms of how these languages, or how these the program and code you write are actually evaluated. There are also other differences in terms of the biggest differences we've seen in terms of variables in the different languages. So can anybody give me a difference between variables in the three languages? Yes?
In C, they're strictly typed. In the other two, they're loosely typed.
And what does that mean?
That in C, you have to declare the type of the variable when you declare the variable, like int or bool or char.
Excellent. In C, we always had to put a type of a variable. And we couldn't really mix types. You couldn't do one or an integer plus a string. But as we've seen in these other languages, you actually can mix types, and you never really have to give something a type ever. So how do we know things are variables in PHP and JavaScript?
In PHP, they start with a dollar sign. Mm-hmm. In JavaScript, when you declare them, you have to have var.
Right. So in PHP, they start with a dollar sign. In JavaScript, they have to have var, although sometimes they don't actually have to have var. But that's correct.
That's true.
So that's a big difference between variables. I think those are probably, off the top of my head, the two biggest differences between these three languages. But yeah.
And the scope of C variables is like restricted to the curly braces, where the other ones is just like it dies if it's like in a function only, but otherwise it's like.
Right.
Yeah.
So scope is a slightly different. In C, as you remember, curly braces define the scope of variables. So if it was defined inside an if condition, which is inside a for loop, the variable only exists there. In JavaScript, if a variable is defined inside an if condition, inside a for loop, it'll exist for that function, but it won't exist outside that function. So scope is a little bit more flexible in JavaScript and PHP. That answer the question? Okay, any other questions? We can do 4 more minutes of questions and we'll jump into coding, yeah.
Can we go into Ajax and talk about what that is? Oh, did we?
Talk to Avi after. He asked that question earlier.
My bad.
No worries.
Yeah, it's your bad. If you want
to go further, yeah.
What exactly is JSON?
What is JSON? What's your question?
Really quickly, a difference between print and echo in PHP.
Okay, so let's do. Why don't you Google the difference between print and echo? Slight difference. Not that big of a deal, but you should definitely Google it, and that'll give you a good answer. JSON, probably bigger of a deal, stands for JavaScript Object Notation. And when have we seen JSON being used? When have you seen, why do you even know the word JSON? When have you seen it? Yeah.
We're getting stock quotes for finance.
So you saw it when you were getting stock quotes for finance. That's and why did you see it?
We were retrieving all the information that came in that format.
So you would get, yeah, go ahead.
Object.
That's yeah. Both of those put together is the answer we're looking for. You want information from this other web page, and you would hope that when you're getting that information, it would be presented to you in some type of standardized format. We've seen everybody's probably familiar with comma-separated values. You can export an Excel spreadsheet or any type of spreadsheet as a list of comma-separated values, and then the commas divide all the different fields. JavaScript Object Notation, JSON, is another type of standardized layout of things. And that's often how we retrieve information from our AJAX queries. So in this case, we got it from the Yahoo site. They returned things to us in a JSON object. And then we know, because it's a standard, what it's going to look like. So we can iterate through the array that's returned to us, the array of objects that are returned to us. We do probably need to know the keys. But they generally give you documentation in the website when you're fetching some JSON notation for them. Likewise, you can JSON encode an object. So there's a function JSON_encode. And so you can take an object that you've created, JSON encode it, and pass it on to something else if you want to. And JSON decode also exists for a similar purpose. Yeah. Or for the opposite purpose.
Do we need to know how to code, or like coding for hash tables and tries? Or do we just need to understand how they're used conceptually?
So raise your hand if you did a hash table for pset 4 with a linked list. So or pset 5. So that was the vast majority of people. Pset 5, 6, who knows? A long time ago. So vast majority of you did hash tables with linked lists. And because that's probably the more common approach, and because we spend a lot of time doing linked lists and hash tables, you should probably be pretty familiar with how to code a hash table and a linked list. And if you think back to that problem set, it wasn't really as hard as you expected. And there was a lot less code than you expected. So you should know how to code. I would say you should know how to code a hash table or a linked list. Not that you'd be asked that necessarily, but you should certainly know that. Also, if you look through past quizzes, there have been a lot of questions about writing functions on linked lists or doubly linked lists. That seems to come up every single year. Write insert on a linked list, write delete from a linked list, write insert for a doubly linked list, et cetera. So that I feel pretty comfortable saying you should know that. For a try, I would say you should certainly know how it works and maybe give some pseudocode for how to code it and set it up. But it would not be the worst thing in the world if you didn't know how to code it in C. It'd be great if you knew how to code it in C, but I think probably pseudocode for a try would be the most you need to know for a try.
Extra credit.
And same with if we go into binary search trees, you might need, and you've seen in the past, we've done a lot of, you know how a binary search tree works, you should probably be able to set one up in pseudocode. But because the vast majority of people didn't do that on the problem set, I would say it's probably less important that you know how to code and set up a tree like that. OK, any other questions? Also, we can ask them throughout as we go through some problems. OK, we're going to move on. Skip that slide for now. Speaking of trees, that is the first question I have for you guys, because this is a problem. I would say it's highly likely you'll get a problem like this on your quiz, asking you to code some type of insert, delete, search for one type of data structure we've seen. That comes up every year, and we spend a lot of time this second half of the semester going over these data types. So right now, I've defined a node in a binary search tree. And what I would like you to do is, given a binary search tree that starts at this node star root. Complete the implementation of the function below, which happens to be a find function, and do it with and without recursion. So I want you to write two functions, one doing this with recursion, one doing this without recursion. And do not assume that the root will be non-null. So we're looking for the integer I in the tree starting at root, and we need to write this recursively and iteratively. Yeah.
So you want us to return true if we find it and false if we don't find it. You don't want
to know.
Huh?
How'd you know that?
Well, I was asking first, but I was assuming because it says bool at the beginning of the function.
Right. It says bool, so I don't even need to tell you what I expect you to return because it says right there. But that's right. Return true or false. So before you begin, I would recommend, if you are unfamiliar with binary search trees, quickly drawing a picture of it to get your understanding right. That'll also help you when writing your code and checking it. Again, you also don't have that much time on the quiz to do all the things that we ask you to do. So writing pseudocode is very helpful. And we generally give about, if the pseudocode is perfectly correct, that's generally 50% on a question. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but if you just write pseudocode and it's correct, that's generally 50%. So I'd always recommend, if you're pressed for time or even if you're trying to figure it out, starting with the pseudocode. And finally, if you could write this all in C, that would be fantastic. So let's take 3 minutes to work on this program. And then we are going to write pseudocode for it just once. And then we're going to code it recursively and then iteratively. If you have any questions, feel free to raise your hand. Happy to walk around and answer them before we start as a group. Let us resume, and we're going to pseudocode the recursive version of this, and then we will code it. So a recursive function needs two things. This might be a question that you could be asked. Needs two things. Who can raise their hand and tell me what the two things a recursive function needs? By definition, it has two things. What are those two things? New hands. Yes, Alden.
So I'm not exactly sure if this is a terminology, but like it needs
I'm
like
glad you're raising your hand.
It needs like a base case.
Great.
And then it needs like a recursive step.
Perfect. It needs a base case and a recursive step. So what's our base case here?
If root equals equals null.
Right. So
or, sorry, just in pseudocode, if it's null. If root is null.
If root is null. That's excellent. That's our base case. That's what we're going to check every time. And base case is the first thing you do. If you hit the base case, you're done. Now we need our recursive call. And I'd be willing to bet we need a couple recursive calls here. Because we have, it's a tree, and we could go multiple ways. So if root is null, we're good. What do you propose? And now I'm going to start calling out on you guys, because I know you guys all know this. But Annie, what should the next line be? What if we found it? What do we do? Or what should be that? Give me the pseudocode for the line where we found it.
If I equals to I.
And then what do we do?
Return true.
Great. So if I is I. Oh, they're both called I. That gets confusing. But if I is I, return true. So that's probably the next thing we should do. Makes sense. OK, now we haven't done a recursive call yet, though, because a recursive call would call this function again. So what should the next line of pseudocode be? Anna?
The left side.
OK. So how do we be specific, though? There's a binary search tree. So what does checking the left side entail?
So node. Root, and then arrow left.
Okay.
Oh, node, sorry. I'm not reading it properly. It's called node, right?
So, well, in this, it'll be called root in our function. But either way, so the left side,
if it doesn't equal I, then we're going to call the function again.
That's right. If it doesn't equal I, we're going to call the function again. But what side of the tree are we going to call the function again?
On the left side.
If it doesn't equal the left, we're not always going to call it on the left if it doesn't equal it.
Oh, sorry, call on the right.
We want to know specifically, though, remember in a binary search tree, everything to the left-hand side is smaller, and everything to the right-hand side is greater. So if it's just not, yeah. Go ahead.
If it's less than I, then.
Okay, yeah.
Wait, if it's on the left.
So if our number, if our I is less than. So if our number is less than I, what side do we want to go to?
We want to go to the right side.
We want to go. Let me draw a quick tree. If this is 5, this will be 3. So if ri is less than 5, what side do we want to go to? Our number is less than the number we're looking at right now.
Oh, then we want to go to the left side.
Exactly.
Yeah, sorry.
So that, no worries. If in the binary search tree, everything lower is to the left, greater is to the right. So if our number is less than the I we're checking, because you see in a node it has an I, then we want to go to the left. And this is an easy one. What is the other line of pseudocode we need to write? Carlos?
Same thing. You just switch it to a greater than sign and go to right.
Can you say it one more time?
If our number is greater than I, go to the right.
Okay. Excellent job on the pseudocode. Let us do this in real code. And again, this pseudocode would probably get you, because it's correct, 50% on this question. But this pseudocode also translates one-to-one, essentially, into code. So let us do this and see who can give me the first line of code. Actually, first, before I do that, let me pull over.
A question.
Yeah,
why did you indent the line I gave you?
Because I couldn't write. I don't know.
All
You're right. That line should be over there. OK, here is our function. And let me pull over also our definition of a node. What happens if we didn't write typedef? Does anybody know?
It wouldn't compile.
It would compile, yeah.
Would it just declare one instance instead of making it a new type you could declare multiple instances of?
So it wouldn't, no, it wouldn't just declare one type. You could still make a lot of nodes.
Wouldn't we have to write struct node every time?
That's right. You would have to write struct node every time instead of just node. But with typedef, you can just write node every single time. OK. Who hasn't given? Yeah, Avika.
If root equals equals null, return false.
Great. And that's our base case. Next line of code. Somebody hasn't given me a line of code yet? Yeah.
Arrow I is equal equal to I. Then return true.
Great. Next line? Yeah. Carlos?
Else if.
And then you can go next. Yeah.
Else if root arrow I is less than I, return function called find root point.
Sorry.
Return find. Root points to left, comma I.
So if RI is greater than the thing in the tree, we want to go to the left?
No, I have that switched.
Which one?
Wait. No, yeah, I have the less than sign there.
Right, if RI is less than what's in the root, our current root, then we want to go to the left. And what's the last line, you?
Basically the same thing, except switch the greater than or to equal mean to less than and left to right.
Excellent. Does anybody have any questions about this? So some other things that would have been correct is this could be, that could be an else if. Guess technically none of these really also need to be else ifs. Also, there's probably only one case down here, so that's probably your last case. So you don't even need that else if. But probably good to write it, to be clear. Yeah?
So you have the quiz. If we make errors, for example, in like syntax, little syntax errors, how does that get taken in the quiz?
They take a lot.
Generally on the quiz, small syntax errors or small style errors don't lose you points. So if you forgot a semicolon here, it would be OK. If you forgot to close this parenthesis, that would be OK. Huge syntax errors that alter the functional meaning of your code dramatically, you might get taken off points for. But we're generally just grading you on whether or not your code functions, even and not its design so much and not its style. Let's now code an iterative version of find. So it's going to be pretty similar, but there are certainly going to be some key differences. However, our pseudocode can probably go, we can still take one line of the pseudocode and figure out what the line is in this case. So in an iterative version, what do you think, Julia, should be the first line?
Again, like an iterative, well, I need to like set up a for loop, right?
Okay.
So, letter for like k or for int x equals 0, like x is less than I, or no, x is less than the size of
the tree. So we don't really know the size of the tree, and we don't really know for how many times we can go. So what's a different type of loop that might be better in this case?
Like if else.
An if else would not be a loop. So what's the type of loop we can just go until some case is met? What is it? What's the only other type of loop in C? Besides a for loop. A what?
While.
While loop, exactly. And a while loop, we don't need to know how. A while loop and for loop can do the exact same thing, but the nice thing about a while loop is we don't need to know how big our tree is. So we're going to go until what?
Until it equals the size of.
Well, it's very similar to our recursive case.
Okay.
So.
Like while root I does not equal I.
That's really close. Yeah. While root I. We could probably. Let's try it. I think we could do while root I does not equal I. We might need to change that a little bit, but that sounds like it's pretty good for now. So we'll do that. Also, remember, we can't assume, per the question, you do not assume that the root will be non-null. So what do you think the very first thing we should do is? Yeah.
If the root equals null, return false.
Great. So we can't. It could be null, so we want to get rid of it right away. And then we're going to check if root I does not equal I. So say we're searching in this tree for 3. Root I does not equal I. Now we're inside our while loop. What do we want to do? And again, it's going to be pretty similar to our recursive version. Yeah.
So you'd want to iterate or keep going down the tree as long as the root is not equal to null. So I'd say, like,
as long as the root is not equal to null?
The root dash I is not equal to null. Or no, so just the root, yeah. As long as the root is not equal to null.
So you want to change this into root does not equal null.
Yeah.
And then, okay.
We could combine these, right? We don't need the if initially. Right?
Okay, so if we don't, if we combine them, so we're going to do while root does not equal null, and if the root happens to be null at the beginning, what do we do down here?
It's return false.
Great. So both ways probably would have worked. This is a different way, and this combines it. But again, if you did either way, we're not going to take off design points on the quiz. But this looks good. So while root does not equal null, what is the first thing we want to check? Somebody else? Noah, what's the first thing?
If ri is less than, oh, I guess if we already found it in the root.
OK.
So if root arrow I is equal to I.
Sorry?
If root arrow I is equals I.
What do we do?
Equals I. Return true.
Great. And what's next? Jeff, what's the next line of code?
If I is less than root arrow I, then root equals root arrow left.
Root equals root arrow left. So that's probably the biggest difference here in this iterative version as opposed to the recursive version. The recursive version, we'd call the function again, albeit we would be updating root when we called the new function. Here, we're not calling a new function. We're simply just updating root in this function. That's excellent. And what is the last line of code? Yeah, Maru?
Else root equals root arrow right.
Sorry?
Root equals root arrow right.
Could you also write something like this?
I have no idea.
No, I mean, you can't. Okay. I cleaned that up. but you can't do plus equals. OK, so this looks good. Why don't we just do that to clean it up? This looks great, and this would work. And we would break out. If root left was null or root right was null, we would come up here. Root would be equal to null. We'd break out of our loop, and we'd return false. So when we break out of the loop, we return false. And again, the while loop was perfect here because we don't know how big our tree is, which we tried to write the for loop, but we realized you got to figure out how big it is ahead of time. Yeah.
If this weren't a binary search tree, it would be real nasty to write it iteratively, right? Like, if it was a tree, but not necessarily, so it wasn't like all smaller on the left and all bigger on the right. it'd be really difficult to iterate over it, right? We'd have to like
right.
save, we'd have to like save what was earlier on in the tree and go back and stuff like
that. If it wasn't a binary search tree, if it was just a tree and things weren't sorted like this,
yeah.
And we realized earlier when Anna was helping us that making it sorted helps us a lot, we would need to, yes, always save where we were previously, but there could be a lot of where we were previously. Right. There could be a lot of parent nodes. Probably the best way to do that would be to like keep pushing things onto some type of stack or queue. You would never need to code this because it's a hard problem. But you push some things onto a stack or a queue and then pop them off and then evaluate them and then have some other thing where you're actually putting the nodes and then create that and then search through that. That might be the best way to do it. OK. Any questions about this problem?
I guess it's like on a related note, will we have to compare runtimes for like hash tables, binary search trees, etc.?
Probably. So let's do that really quickly. Runtime for hash table, what are the others? Binary tree? Okay, let's do insert. What is the run big O of insert on a hash table? With one, and what are the assumptions you're making?
You're inserting the beginning of the link.
Probably the first assumption is there are no collisions. If there are no collisions, then the insertion time is one. If there are collisions, and you're inserting at, and you're doing separate chaining and inserting at the beginning of the linked list, then insertion is also constant. If you're doing a hash table, but you have a different method of dealing with collisions, what's the different method? What's a different method of dealing with collisions in a hash table?
Linear
probing. So we're going to keep looking for the next open spot. That is not constant insertion time. You could have to go through the entire table. So that could be big O of n. Yeah.
Otherwise, just chaining, I think?
No. We did separate chaining.
Separate chaining.
That was the first one. That's with the linked list. That's the fancy name is separate chaining. It could be any type of list structure. We happen to do a linked list. So again, insertion on a hash table could be constant time. What about insertion on a stack or a queue? It's constant time. You're just pushing it on. OK. Insertion, what were the other ones? On a try? What is big O of insertion on a try?
The length of the one is
yeah.
The length of the word you're inserting.
Sorry? Wait, so what I hear, you said, what'd you say? What was your answer, Marcus?
Oh, the length of the word you're inserting in characters, assuming it's a character try.
OK, so the length of the word, we'll make an assumption that it's a string of characters. And would you said something different, though.
No, I agree with him.
You said length of the longest word. Yeah.
That's just constant, right?
Like, why would it be constant?
Like if you use big O notation, then it doesn't vary based on the number of things that are already in the tree, or in the try.
So we would say it's constant time.
OK.
It is. Constant insertion, and that's because this idea, say we have a word that's 45 or a word that's 60, that is a constant number, and it would just be inserted in constant time. In practice, though, it would not be obviously happen in 1 millisecond, for example. But we would say big O is constant for a try, and that's one of its biggest advantages. What about insertion into a linked list, just a generic sorted linked list? Yeah.
I had a question. So like on the test, would they ever ask us like the insertion time is like 4 steps or something? Or is it just like when you say insertion time is 1, that just means constant time?
Yeah, they would always ask, is it big O of n, big O of like log n, n squared, constant? Okay. Those are really the only ones you need to know. What about insertion on a sorted linked list?
I had a question before.
Yeah.
So would it be like,
what's the answer to that question, though?
Wait, what did you ask, though?
What is big O of insertion into a sorted linked list?
1? No, wait, n.
The size of the linked list. OK, and what was your question?
So would you write O of k or like O of 1 for the other
one? Oh, I would write O of 1, probably.
1? OK.
There was one other data structure that would have been good.
Binary
tree, binary search tree. What's insertion on a binary search tree?
Log.
Log n.
Log n.
So what is the worst case in a binary search tree?
Oh,
n. So if every number is, if 5 happens, if we happen to start at 5 and every number is greater than 5, then we go like 5, 7, 9, 11, etc. In this case, it's basically just a linked list, and we need to insert all the way at the end, so it's big O of n. That could be our worst case on a binary search tree. Obviously, you would never construct a binary search tree with 5 in the middle, knowing it was like 5 would be the lowest number. But it could be if you're starting from scratch. Any questions on this before we move on to another question? That was a good question. I would know big O of.
What about searching for those 4?
I would know, searching. Definitely, we did searching and sorting. You did all those algorithms, right? Wait, where was that for quiz 1? Is that covered? Did you already have that question in quiz 1? The big O runtime of binary search, insertion sort, bubble sort?
Yeah.
If you had that question on quiz 0, odds are you won't get the same exact question on quiz 1. Might be still good to know those. You should hopefully know those already. But other logarithmic runtimes are probably good to know, things that weren't covered on quiz 0, like all these operators on these data or abstract data types. OK, let's move on. This one should be pretty quick. And this is a new language we've had, haven't actually coded in before. This is a question asking you to code in PHP. So consider the PHP array below. Write PHP and or HTML code such that it outputs a 2-column table with TF's names and houses. This is, you've never done this before, this specific problem, but this should be very familiar to what you did in problem set 7. So I would be willing to bet you will be asked to code something in PHP that is very similar to what you did in problem set 7. Firstly, what array is not that specific. What type of array is this? It's an associative array. And what's the difference between an associative array and an object?
Headers.
Yeah.
An object array has an index of integers, and an associative array is an index of a string or something like that.
So an associative, or an array of objects would have indices or indices of integers, but an object, it has fields. It has those fields names like name, house, student. Do you have an idea?
Oh, well, I mean, associative array is in PHP, right? And object is in JavaScript?
So we probably, well, you can have, yes. So honestly, there's no real difference between the two. Yeah. Both have strings as the keys and can have basically anything as the value. Different languages call one thing associative array, one thing an object. So honestly, there is no real difference. But there are certainly some syntactical differences between the two. Yeah.
So is object also coded under the hood as a hash table, then?
What do you mean coded under the hood?
So we were told that associative array was technically a hash table.
OK.
So is object also technically a hash table?
I'm not going to answer that question. I'll get back to you on that. But I wouldn't think of either of those like that. But in any way, associative array and object generally even called, people use those terms interchangeably. In this case, the cool part is you can use keys, strings as keys, rather than just simple numbers. So I've been talking about this for a while. Hopefully, some people have gotten started on this. We're going to write some PHP and HTML code such that we get a 2-column table with TF's names and houses. OK, I also would like a header row on this table. So I'm going to get straight into this. We're going to file new, and we're going to OK, how do I start a table? What's the tag, Michael, to start a table?
Table.
And if I open a tag, what else do I need?
A head, or class.
So sorry, assume that we've already written doctype, HTML, all that stuff. So, but if I open this table tag, what else do I need to write?
Would you need to
valid HTML.
Close the tag.
How do I write a close table tag?
/table.
Slash table. Great. Probably makes sense to write both of those together because you know you got to do it. Okay. If I want a header row, how do I write a header row with titles? Yeah.
Is it open or less than sign HR close? TR. And then same thing, the slash, yeah.
OK, and give me, I want 2 columns.
TD.
OK. And I want 2 columns. Is this give me 2 columns? How many columns is this? 1. So let's copy and paste this. actually this code in this on the quiz, all of this code that we've written so far was actually given to you. But you should probably still know how to write it. Yeah.
Your second or your house is outside or is between the two.
Boom. Thanks. Should go right there, right?
Yeah.
Good call. So again, all this code was actually given to you on the actual quiz, but it's fun to write it and you should know how to write it. So this is where you needed to start, your code. What do we write right here? Sorry, I need to change the name of this file. So it was saved in a .html file, not a .php file. These things would mean nothing in a .php file. So we're in a .html file. What is the first thing I need to write? I want to put some PHP code in an HTML.
The little PHP, like another caret, and like question mark PHP, right?
Great. And how do I end that?
With a question mark.
That's great. That's the first thing I need if I want to put some PHP code in here.
Wait, I thought a .php file could take HTML.
Yeah. A .php file can take some HTML and be displayed. That was my bad. I was just trying to mimic what it was on the quiz.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry to confuse you.
Okay.
Yes, practice.html. Now we're going to put some PHP code in. What is the first line of PHP code I should write? I want to go through this array and make it into a table. Yeah.
You can either use a for each loop or a for loop.
Okay. What do you want to use?
I want to use a for loop.
Okay.
For, and then you do $i equals 0, semicolon, $i less than 2, and then semicolon I plus plus, $i plus plus.
How do you know to use a 2?
Because there were two associative arrays within the bigger associative array.
So the big thing's not an associative array. The big thing's just a normal array.
Yeah.
But you're right, there are two associative arrays inside our larger array. That's why I use 2. I feel uncomfortable assuming that they're 2. So what's a way to write this without assuming that they're 2?
For each loop.
Okay, how do you write that?
For each $TF as TF, or like $TF. Yep.
Okay, so for each TFs as TF, I want to now again have my table. So who else can give me the next line of code? Yeah.
Print, and then in quotations, bracket tr, and bracket end quote, and parentheses, semicolon.
Okay, and what's that going to do?
It's going to say new row. It's going to put the tag for a new row.
Right. This PHP, like we talked about earlier, this PHP is going to be evaluated. And then it's going to print out to this file a table row. And then that HTML will be evaluated. So this is going to, we're just copying this HTML we had up here. Yeah. Sorry? It's right here, fall 2012. But don't look at the answers. Let's solve it together. So we print table row. So you're probably in the swing of things. What's the next line of code we need to write? Assam, give me the next line of code.
You need the TF's name.
Okay.
So TF open brackets, quotation mark name, and then close brackets. Yeah.
So that'll give me their name.
But print. You, okay.
Hmm?
You need to print that.
Just put it inside the
room. Okay. Have it printed. Oops. I'm missing something though. What am I missing?
Do you need a dollar sign?
What else am I missing? All we've printed so far is the TR.
Oh, close the TR after it.
So we need to close the TR after.
You can do this, is what I'm saying.
Who sees what we're missing on line 16? Yeah, Anna.
You need to open a TD and curly braces.
And where do we put curly braces?
Oh, around the TF name.
Like this?
Yeah. And then close the TD.
You do
like that?
Do you need double quotation marks next to the curly braces?
Right here? No, yeah. You don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, you should use dots.
So that's exactly right. Yeah.
So the difference between that and like concatenating with dots is if you use dots, you'd have to have the double quotation marks, then a dot, then it, then the dot.
Correct.
Then it.
Okay. They were saying there's an alternate way of writing this, like that. What's the concatenation operator in JavaScript?
Plus.
A plus sign.
You forgot to put the curly brace back.
Great. And one, there's one more line of code we're missing. Who can give me the last line of code we're missing?
Just the exact same thing, except with house instead of name.
Great. And Assam, your syntax was exactly right for getting things in an associative array. So in the actual quiz, you were actually given up until here. So this code was all given to you. All you had to write were these four lines and remember to close the table tag. You guys actually did all of that and more. Yeah.
So it would be functionally the same if you just had that all in one big print call, right? And then just like concatenated it on, et cetera.
Like that?
Yeah.
And then
just
so on, so on.
It just wouldn't look good if you were looking at it when you were like inspecting the element on your website, right?
I agree.
It would functionally be the same.
I agree. Yep. You also, would I ever be able, so would if I loaded this web page, would I be able to see this PHP code ever?
Oh, no. Right.
No. And actually, I wouldn't.
This is an HTML, right? So you might be able to see.
But this PHP would be evaluated server side.
Oh, okay.
PHP is always evaluated server side, so you're never able to see PHP code.
But you'd be able to see the result of the prints.
Right. And it honestly might not put it all on one line. It might format it nicely for you, or it might put it on one line. Unclear. But yes, good point. Uh-huh.
How come there's no like text highlighting for any of the PHP commands? So I remember seeing that.
Because it's a .html file up here at the top.
Okay.
Let's go. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay. Akshar?
If we did like the initial method with just the for loops, right? If we wanted to access a TF, would we have to do like TFs bracket 0 bracket then name?
You would, so you're saying for the for loop, yeah, you would do $TFs bracket 1 or I,
yeah.
Right? Or $I close bracket and then square bracket double quotes. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. We have one more quick one, and I 7 minutes, so I want to go over this one. This is another example. We're now a totally other language. We have some HTML code. It's in small. It's kind of small on the screen, but I want you to look through really quickly, and can somebody tell me if I were to load this web page what I would see? Like, describe everything about this web page. Noah? What would I see?
Coded the front end of Google with a field for text and a field for a submit button.
And what would the button say?
Submit.
Mm.
Oh, search. I'm sorry.
It would say search. Remember, name, what do we use name for? This name attribute, what's that used for?
That's for when listening to when it's clicked, right?
It could be, but when do we generally see, like, why are we giving this name Q? When do we see that? Yeah?
Does that become the index of the super global variable?
Yeah, generally it? When we do a get or post, or when this form would submit, and then where would this submit to? What page? No? What page would this submit to?
No page, right?
I'm not sure.
Where do you think we could find it? Where do you find what page it submits to? What line of code?
Form action?
Form, exactly, action. So it submits to the search page, /search.
Oh, yeah.
That's exactly right. And what method?
Get,
exactly. So that's we read this. This is going to be a form. You're exactly right. Two things on the form. The title of the page in the top would be Google. So here are two questions you should be able to answer about this page. If this HTML lives at this website and a user inputs bug into this text field right here. What URL will the user find herself at upon submitting the form? So we have this right here. I'm going to go back to this page, though. I'll write up this first part. Can everybody see over here? OK. Madhu, you think you know?
Yeah. Just
what that page?
That slash search.
Oh my, I'm going to move down here. Let me fix this. OK, that slash search.
Question mark. Q equals bug.
Anybody have a different suggestion? Yeah.
I think that's right.
So how do we get this? Well, we've seen this before. And you came up with this earlier. You were right, Noah, that the action is telling us what page we're going to. We also know what method. We're doing get. And the difference between get and post is that get displays in the URL and post doesn't. So if that, I wrote post right there in the method, what would be different?
It would just be slash search.
It would just be slash search. Nothing over here would happen. But because it's a get, the URL is displayed as follows. First, we see a question mark. Then we see the name and the value. Say there was one other text field, and I gave it a name of R, and I input a value caterpillar. What would this now look like? I have one more text field. I give it a name of R and a value of caterpillar. Yeah.
After bug, you'd have the ampersand caterpillar.
That's not an ampersand.
Or whatever the and symbol. And
yeah, no, I was I you were right. I was wrong.
Okay. I think
that's not, that's like a G.
Caterpillar.
R equals
R equals caterpillar, sorry.
Is that how you spell caterpillar?
I don't think there's an R.
Yeah. Is there no R there?
No, there is. There is an R.
We'll talk about that after class. That's exactly right.
There's definitely an R.
So the and is correct, and then you could have many of these, and they would all be concatenated together with that and. So that's exactly right. There's one more question. Sketch this HTL's DOM, starting with document. We can do that in 2 minutes. We'll do it over here. I'll go back to this web page. OK, we start with document.
There is an R, but on the quiz it's spelled wrong.
Yeah, the quiz is spelled without
yeah,
an R,
it's
right?
Not, it's spelled without an R on the quiz.
What's next?
But there is an R
okay.
In real life.
So when you're
HTML.
Reading through a
HTML
is next. We're going to go tag by tag. What's after HTML?
Head.
Head. What's after head?
Title.
And then title has a value of Google, but I'm not going to write that in for now. OK, where does body go?
Also coming off of the HTML.
Exactly. Body comes off of here. Does everybody see why that's the case? You should probably be able to figure this out, too, even if I didn't have this nice indentation. The indentation sort of gives it away. But you can see that the head tag has been closed, which means we probably can't go down here. We need to go back up to whatever was right before the head tag. And we're under that. We're even with the head tag. And under body goes form. Under form, there are two inputs. OK. That's all I got. Quiz one is tomorrow. I'm so excited for you guys. It's going to be a blast. If you have, stop. No, I'm kidding. If you have any questions, right after section, I'll be outside. If you have any questions tonight, feel free to call, email, GChat, carrier pigeon me. Good luck tomorrow. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving break if I don't see you before then. And I will see you after Thanksgiving on Tuesday for our final section party ever.
I really need feedback in your
earbuds. Great. OK, I'll see you guys next week or in 2 weeks. And good luck tomorrow.